Welcome to Literally Loitering, and yes, you're not listening to On The Box. Obviously, you know you're not listening to On The Box because you've just clicked Literally Loitering. But I'm back. It's Andy.
Yes. The mysterious stranger has returned, but we're also joined by a second mysterious stranger who rarely graces us with his presence.
Yeah, I think I'm under 10 appearances for Literally Loitering in all of its guises.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is true.
I've got a few under my belt.
Yes. Not as many as Andy. But Andy has been missing for a while.
Yes. I've been doing other shows.
But he's returned. We've replaced Andrew with Andy. Because Andrew has gone...
Very complete.
He's gone to Cornwall. He's gone to Newquay. He's gone surfing. He's hanging 10.
He's gone surfing.
Yes.
Oh, there's a picture of Andrew just surfing on that ice-cold Cornwall lake.
Lake?
Lake.
You don't surf on lakes.
Newquay's right
on the
coast.
Tell that to Andrew.
I've heard the Atlantic Ocean called many things, but I've never heard it called a lake.
If that's a lake, what's an ocean? Blimey. Together we are replacing Andrew for now, for today.
Yes, Andrew, if you're listening, you're so good we had to replace you with two people.
So when you finish surfing on a lake, we'll welcome you back here.
Yes.
With open arms, but... we'll welcome you back here.
With a nonchalant, non-committal... Yeah.
Maybe a Tonic's caramel bar.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, but we are Literally Loitering. We'll get on with it.
We're not supposed to use brand names.
Other caramel bars do exist.
Yes.
Yes, they do.
Anyway, moving into the news and the Guardian Children's Fiction Prize for 2016, they've actually announced the long list, which is an interesting selection. You have Chasing the Stars by Mallory Blackman, which is a retelling of Othello in space. Olivia, known as V, and her twin brother Aidan, no, not Cinema Collectica Aidan.
No, I didn't think so.
Yep. They are heading back to Earth after a deadly virus has killed their family and the rest of their crew. Their lonely existence is invaded when V decides to take in space refugees. She's not prepared to fall madly in love with one of them, but can love survive in an atmosphere of lies and deception?
Yeah, it can. Crazy.
If it doesn't, it'll be a very bad ending.
Yes.
That was all right. It was just a bit of a to-do, you know. Anything that's reframed through Yorkshire terms in space is better.
Next up is The Marvels by Brian Selznick, I think it is. And it's not clear what this book is about. Apparently, in 1776, Billy Marvel was shipwrecked on a whaling ship, and then the story shifts to the 20th century and the tale of a young guy called Joseph. So, not very clear what this is all about.
Time skips. Have to read it.
Time skips, yes.
Well, there's a lot of stories that have the imprint of a story through history. So, a story originally will happen, and then it'll have like a 200 years in the future and how it still affects things. Yeah. That's how Cloud Atlas made a lot of its stupid fans.
Yeah, I know. But
I don't like Cloud Atlas, it's terrible.
Yeah. Anyway, moving on to Riverkeep by Martin Stewart, which apparently is an epic quest to find a mythic sea beast, 15-year-old William. William
is he
spelled W-U-L-L-I-A-M. Is about to take up his father's mantle as Riverkeep when his father is possessed by an evil spirit and Wool must embark on a dangerous journey to the sea. Apparently, it's Moby Dick for young readers.
That's a bit condescending.
Yeah.
Can't you read Moby Dick when you're a young age? Is it got like an 18 rated or something?
You wouldn't have said Wool there. Like, it sounds like it's a typo.
Yeah.
Because the U is next to the I on the keyboard.
Yep, I know. Anyway.
Yeah, he QWERTY'd your backside, right, man?
Yes, he did.
got you good there.
Moving on to Crongton Nights by Alex Wheatle, which I've got to say, the cover of this one is actually quite striking. South Crongton Council Estate is a place of ancient feuds and tensions and home to McKay. He's overweight, worried about his dad and brother, grieving for his lost mother, and he dreams of being a chef one day. So, yeah.
Apparently, that's kind of odd.
Apparently,
sounding.
There's echoes of Arthurian legend in this, which is why it's called Crongton Knights.
Well, that's kind of interesting, you know. I mean, the idea, getting into meaningful jibber-jabber here, but the whole old world where we used to operate, sort of the strongest led from the front, and that whole world was like so dominant for centuries, and it just stopped.
Yeah.
Like, the idea of what would happen if that world still existed, maybe not as the dominant force, but in a modern-day setting, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
It's an interesting what-if, and if that book has captured that, well then, yeah, excellent.
Got quite an interesting-looking cover as well, though. A standy-outy cover.
You know, Alex Wheatle's got some experience with children's books as well, that one might be an interesting read. Moving on to a book by Bonnie Sue Hitchcock, and I love the title of this book, The Smell of Other People's Houses.
Well, now they've got me really paranoid about that.
Remember, this section says, The Smell of Other People's Houses is Intoxicating by Publishers Weekly.
Yes.
Do you think they meant that?
Yes.
No, I think that the marketing department for the publishers has actually work that in there really well, but
It's like those movies or TV shows or anything where, like, The Amazing Spider-Man.
Yeah,
it just, I can't think of any other examples off the top of my head, but it's just an opportunity for critics to go, no, it ain't the mediocre Spider-Man, something like that.
Yes,
and that's just the same. The smell of other people's houses is lovely and luxurious and intoxicating, or it smells like poop.
Yes.
It's just an opportunity. It sets up the critics.
Anyway.
That sort of thing.
This is apparently about the lives of young people in 1970s Alaska. And apparently there are multiple protagonists in this. So that one, actually, the title's got me, The Smell of Other People's Houses.
The Smell of Young People's Houses in 1970s Alaska.
It sounds like a documentary.
Yeah. Next one is by... next one is a book by G.R. Gemmin called Sweet Pizza. G.R. Gemmin is the author of Cowgirl and was shortlisted for the Waterstones Children Book Prize as well.
Sweet Pizza, is that those pizzas you can go to, like, supermarkets and it's like a pizza made out of sweets?
Possibly, I don't know.
You're talking about that?
The idea is Joey's a boy from South Wales. He lives in the cafe started by his Italian great-grandfather, now in tatty decline. He's crazy about food and opera and full of original ideas to bring in the customers. And he also finds out about the history of the Italian community in Wales.
That sounds a bit documentary-ish as well.
Yeah.
But no.
The next one is a book by Tanya Landman, and apparently she is a Carnegie Medal-winning author. The cover isn't impressing me too much because it seems like those typical kind of, oh, look, let's make things heroic, let's add some action on the cover because somebody in the marketing department...
Has it got a shot of somebody leering in the literal camera of the illustration with a gun, with a shirt unbuttoned, and he's looking heroic, and there's a girl holding his arm, like 1950s pulp sci-fi cover.
Well, why don't you just take a quick look at the cover, and then you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about.
Looks like it's got a boat, but it looks like a Jaden Smith or something, just staring off into the... I like the tagline.
Well, the expression of the kid in the front is like he's done something naughty. He's like he's hiding the cereal and he hopes his parents doesn't find it.
Well, to be honest, it looked...
He's an honest man.
Yeah, in a wicked world, can an honest man survive?
No.
So it looks like he's just farted and then gone, yeah, sorry, that was me. And then now he's being chased by those ships.
I hope they don't blame me. I think it was that guy there.
According to the New Statesman, it's heart-stoppingly good. So if I read this, will I have a heart attack?
Yeah, it's those adjectives to throw onto, like, a quality.
Yeah.
I know, it might be actually a good book. Maybe just a picture giving it a
cinematic
feel.
It's called Hell and High Water, and no, that is not referring to a cowboy movie of the same name. So, yeah. All's well for Caleb and his dad. They're showmen taking their Punch and Judy show through 18th century England, but all falls apart when Caleb's dad is falsely accused of stealing a purse and is sentenced to transportation. Determined to expose the truth, Caleb is caught up in a fast-moving series of events that expose webs of corruption, racism, and immorality.
There's an awful lot of that.
Yeah.
In all sorts of media where it has this really innocuous profession where it'll have, like, its heroes and it'll use that as sort of an opportunity to just shine a light on the social issues.
Yeah,
right. As they go on a road trip or do their job or whatever, like run a shop. It's very common right now.
Yeah. Next up is The Bone Sparrow by Zana Freyon, or Freylon, however you pronounce her name. The tagline for this is One Story, the Story of Millions. And apparently this is a coming-of-age story about Subi, a boy born in a refugee camp who has never known life outside an immigration detention center. But apparently it's also a story of many shades and textures. And there's darkness, light, poetry, humor, all sorts of stuff, allegedly. I haven't read this, so I'm just reading the blurb that's given with it.
How many more books are there?
There's only 8.
I feel like there's been 100.
They all seem to be rather serious toned.
Yeah.
About issues recently.
They're all very similar.
Mm. There's no comedy. There's no light-hearted comedy. There's nothing actually to lighten the mood. And that's the thing that gets me about these, about all of these book prizes and all the books that apparently appeal to children, is that apparently children don't like to laugh anymore.
To be recognised as an artist. Oh, an artist, you know.
Serious artist.
You've got to have a furrowed brow and talk about serious stuff and have like a monobrow and a moustache. I don't know where that's coming to it, but yeah, you've got to be very serious.
Yes.
Very, very serious.
Yeah, but all the funny stuff seems to be adult. Yeah. When we cover book titles, for example, and things like that, they're not kids.
Oh, no, there's some amazing stuff that is hilarious, but is clearly not aimed at adults only.
So I can't read The Very Hungover Caterpillar, and that was hilarious.
Yeah, but we also went over, a while ago on Literary Loitering, we went over 10 alternative insults taken from Shakespearean plays. And they were hilarious, and for all ages.
Yeah, I mean, it's gone back a bit more, but the kid book that Terry Pratchett did.
Which one? He did several.
One of the later ones that we covered on the show.
Are you on about The Shepherd's Crown?
No. It was a picture book.
Oh, Diggers. Oh, no.
It's children's picture book.
You were on about Where's My Cow?
Yes, there we go.
Yes. Where's My Cow? Yes. Is that my cow? It goes, rrr, that's not a cow.
And it kind of gets very existential and weird.
It does. It goes off on one. Where's my cow? Is that my cow? It goes, bugger it, Millennium Hand and Shrimp. That's not my cow. That's foul old Ron from the Beggars Guild.
I'm thinking, what was the state of mind when you planned that book?
I don't care.
It's like,
well, it's what state of mind of any Pratchett book when he was still with us. He had a very eccentric thought process for something he came out with. So
yeah,
it's like a pin down. What was he thinking about? I don't know. Why try to bottle the magic?
Exactly. It really is. The bromeliad that he came out with, which is Diggers, Truckers and Wings. I just love the first one, Truckers. And in Truckers, the gnomes are living in a department store. And every time they mention I think it's Arnold Brothers department store. And they always refer to it as Arnold Brothers established. And then the shop was made.
Oh, right. Okay,
every time they mention the department store, they always refer to it like that.
Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, it makes sense. But yeah, he has a very eccentric imagination, so
yeah,
don't try and bottle it.
No, we're not going to. Anyway, moving on to, because that's a shortlist for winning a prize, but how can you become successful? How can you become a best-selling author, right?
And write a self-help book.
No,
apparently,
right, the former acquisitions editor for Penguin UK, Jody Archer, and an associate professor of English at the University of Nebraska, Matthew Jockers, they've been working together, they've compiled data for the last 5 years, and they've been trying to find out what makes a bestseller.
Is this one of these things where they've got like a mathematical formula?
Yes, it's an algorithm.
They've got an algorithm.
They've got an algorithm for a bestseller. They analysed 20,000 randomly selected novels from the past 3 decades, and they have a new algorithm that they call the bestsellerometer.
Just no imagination of that.
No, there isn't. So anyway, they call it the bestsellerometer, and apparently it measures certain aspects of books such as theme, plot, style, character, and vocabulary, and it tells you whether it will be a bestseller, and they claim it can pick out a future bestseller to an 80% degree of accuracy.
That's pretty good, not the best.
They need to try it with proven bestsellers just to see if it works.
Well, they will have within that 20,000 books.
Now, here's the thing, right? You know how sometimes common sense and logic intrudes on the realm of science and goes, yeah, I was here first.
It was an interesting documentary on that theme. I can't remember. Tim's Vermeer, I think it was called, where it tried to see if a robot could accurately, or a robot CPU or however you're defining it with your technology and your la-di-da, but whether a computer could recreate art, or whether art was an entirely emotional thing. And it's very related to that.
Well, it is kind of, but when I say common sense and logic, I mean, if you sit down and thought about something, right, you'd begin to understand that certain things are fundamental to, say, a bestseller. What is the most important thing that makes a bestseller?
Sauciness.
Nope.
That's been a lot of them.
No. The most important thing that makes a bestseller.
I'd like to say grammar, but I know that isn't true.
A good story.
Actually having a story. Cover. No. Actually having a story in the first place.
And a catchy cover.
No. Actually having a story in the first place makes a bestseller. Because if it's just a bunch of words, it's a dictionary. And
the key to being a bestseller is to have a story.
Hang on.
Well, obviously.
But that's the thing. According to these people who made the bestsellerometer, Jodi Archer has said, we found out that the use of plot line is very important.
it's like, why isn't my car working? And somebody popped up and saying, fuel is a very important ingredient. Says, oh, thank you, Mr. Petrolometer. And you get on with it. Stupid.
Oh, my God.
You're saying, Andy?
I forgot what I was saying.
Sorry. Petrolometer kind of took dominion.
Jodi Archer goes on to say, the perfect curves of fiction, the use of usually emotional and stylistic language to create these very symmetrical curves. What the hell are you talking about?
That's very abstract.
Is that like the book, like, layout, like, the book spine is supposed to be a specific shape? Or?
Well, let's put it this way. The way I described it to Lewis when I was explaining the difference between plot, story, narrative, that sort of thing, was the plot is basically your signposts. Those are the events that are going to happen throughout the story. It's kind of like a road map, but a very, very Spartan map. It's, you know, when you draw a map for somebody, how to go from here to here, yes. You just draw it with lines, right? That's basically your plot, right? The story goes from here to here to here to here. These things happen along the way. That's it. That's your basic plot. You might have little things branching off, you know, little side streets, but that's your basic plot. Just that simple line, right? Going from A to B. You build your story around that, and your story is made up of the narrative, which is the flow of the story, everything like that, the characters, the dialogue, all that stuff that all comes in to make up the entirety of the story. So when she says the use of plot line is very important, like, well,
I've not really read a book which doesn't have a plot.
Even self-help books have a plot.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, because they want to help you.
Exactly. Now, she goes on to say, novels with high or low emotions tend to have a stronger chance of hitting the bestseller lists and staying on them.
What's low emotion? Is it just a book of, you know...
High emotions is basically, look at us, we're all wonderful. And low emotion is, I'm so unhappy, I want to cut myself.
So basically, if you want to be really successful, be bipolar.
Yes.
That's what they're saying.
Basically, that comment is... you have to vary. You have to basically have low points and you have to have high points in your story, basically.
Which is the start.
Like which is a story. Yeah.
Which is the pathway of every story. It's got to have highs and low points.
You can't just keep on going all the way up, can it? Like, it can't be just a happy story. I know there's a happy story, but it has to have some peril in the middle. Where
a happy story isn't happy if it hasn't got some sort of sadness to conflict that and exaggerate it and make it more triumphant as a resolution or
see,
a fake
this is where,
resolution.
This is where I start disagreeing with the findings. Not that I didn't already. Or, like I said, common sense. We do need a story. We need a plot in order for us to have a bestseller.
What's next,
in the first
words?
Place. No. A couple of pointers from the findings. Apparently, real people are more appealing to readers than fictional beings. So stay away from dwarves, unicorns, and elves as main protagonists.
What they're saying is autobiographies.
No, what they're saying is that readers are speciesist. They don't like any non-human species.
Well, even
elves are basically human.
Yeah,
just got
to a degree.
Big ears. point your ears, haven't they?
Wow.
And a crossbow.
Not all of them have, you know. That's discrimination, that is, Andy.
Well, a bow and arrow. Crossbow is an upgrade, isn't it?
Okay. So, dwarves, yeah.
No, but it's also saying that autobiographies are aware.
Yeah.
Which is very, very, very shallow look at the world.
Yeah. Also, right, those characters who appeal the most are also more likely to grab, think, and ask. These are doing words. The words need, want, and do are twice as likely to appear in bestsellers, while the word okay appears three times as much. Words like love and miss appear more often in successful books, apparently appearing three times for every two in lesser-selling books.
Huh.
Which is the reason why, even though 50 Shades of Grey has sex in every chapter, it does not necessarily make it a bestseller. Readers are more interested in the curves of fiction, according to this algorithm and their findings.
It's flowery words written by idiots.
Yes.
This is what this report is.
Yes. See,
if you want to truly judge what a successful book makes, you have a much bigger panel of books, a much bigger cross-section of books to use as samples. You go through, like, the past 100 years, because it goes through periods. I mean, say Lord of the Rings came out, and everybody rushes to get the Lord of the Rings book. There's always things like this that happen. A movie that gets adapted, and everybody goes back to get the books. So it's completely skewing the sample if you used to use the past 10 years. And also, people with an iota, a scrub of intelligence to actually find these, look at this report and make this report.
See, the thing that bugs me about this, right, they've gone back through 3 decades, they say. Right.
Even so.
3 decades of
everything
books.
I said is still true.
No, I actually agree with you. Do you know what annoys me? I was talking to my niece the other day, right? And she was talking about stuff she's doing in school. Now, she's in secondary school. I think she's in her final year of secondary school. And she was talking about English and stuff like that. And I said, okay, so read a new book. It's called A Natural History of Dragons. It's amazing. It's like a Victorian period drama with dragons thrown in and loads of natural history, loads of scientific research, that sort of thing. Brilliant, amazing main character in Lady Trent. And, you know, it's just an amazing book series. And she goes, oh, I'd really like to read that, but what's a Victorian period drama?
Oh, dear.
And I looked at her and I said, so have you not read Jane Austen or any of the Brontes or Charles Dickens or anything like that? She goes, I've heard of Charles Dickens. And I just looked at her and went, what the hell are they teaching you in school? She went, well, we've studied a lot of Shakespeare.
That's the easy go-to.
Yeah. And I said to her, Jane Austen wrote Pride and Prejudice, which is considered one of the greatest books ever written in the English language. She goes, oh, yeah, Pride and Prejudice.
The film.
And her dad was there, and I said to her, I said to my brother, right, her dad, I looked at him, I said, you need to have serious words with that school if they're only teaching her Shakespeare.
But schools do. It's like the only, when I was at school, the only other book really that went through, the only other two other books that they did at GCSE level was, they did all Shakespeare stuff, but was Blood Brothers, a play, wasn't even a, and Mice and Men.
I'm sorry, but that explains why the standard of English education is going downhill.
And the sad thing is, there was two separate distinctions of English, so they had like an even larger amount of time to commit to looking at English literature. One was English language, one was English literature.
Yeah.
And language makes sense, it's writing and whatnot, but literature, you have basically a blank slate to do whatever you want. Well, and to say, only Shakespeare isn't technically literature.
No, it's not.
It's all plays. And
but the thing is, if you're going to do English literature...
It's basically scripts.
Yeah. When I did English literature in school, we had Dickens, we had the Brontes, we had Jane Austen, we had To Kill a Mockingbird and Of Mice and Men and Grapes of Wrath, right? Those were books that we had to actually cover. We had all of these books and Shakespeare on top of that. So, yeah.
I don't like the name Grapes of Wrath. It makes me giggle like a six-year-old schoolgirl.
Hey. It's the Grapes of Wrath, not the Plums of Anger.
Very small.
It's the second book.
It's a small degree of separation there, Rob.
What's the fair one? The Grapefruits of Doom?
No. Not the Grapefruits of Doom.
Pears of Melancholy. I don't know. Nonsense.
Anyway. We're going to move on to our final news story, and it's never a good news day unless there's a Trump there. What's been happening here, Andy?
Well, quite a lot's been happening here, Bob. I'll start it off by just reading the top line. If you're at a loss to explain the phenomenon that is Donald Trump to your children,
yes,
help may be at hand. From A Child's First Book of Trump, published this week. US comedian and writer Michael Ian Black has written a book published by Simon & Schuster, and although the 32-page picture book is released under the publisher's Books for Young Readers imprint, it's more likely to appeal to adults.
I love the picture where it just says America's Trumpus.
Black, yeah, who lives in Connecticut, describes a presumptive Republican presidential candidate thus. The beastie is called an American Trump. Its skin is bright orange. Its figure is plump. Its fur so complex you might get enveloped. Its hands are sadly underdeveloped. And where does it live? On flat-screen TVs. It rushes towards every camera it sees. It thrives in the most contentious conditions and excretes the most appalling emissions. It's in a Dr. Seuss style. Yeah. And,
bright orange beastie.
Can we review this?
I'm going to put in a request for this because I really want to feature this.
Yeah, the picture was just brilliant.
Child's First Book of Trump. See, if you say that to an English child, they're going to go, I'm getting a book about farts. Well, they are. They're going to be excited by it as well. Going to see what kind of weird noises they can make.
There was a gag on Family Guy about the future where one of the contenders was President Douchebag, and he ran a really good campaign, so you can't call people that anymore.
Yeah.
They're going to use the word Trump for that, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
So you go out the future, says you Trumped, says you can't say that anymore. It was President Trump, and he
was the greatest president in US history.
Yeah.
I don't know.
He plunged the world into World War 3, 4, 5, and 6. Well, and he lost them all.
The thing is, that's not the only thing that's happened with Donald Trump. Aside from the, I think it's unresolved so far, you know, the nude portrait.
Ah, the Akon penis beauty.
Yeah, the one scene never forgotten. Andy, we'll show you afterwards. That way you can share the horror. Anyway, aside from that, Trump is also appearing in a Gwenpool comic. Gwenpool is basically Gwen Stacy, Deadpool, all combined type thing. As a supervillain called Mordark, mental organism designed as America's king, and it's based upon the long-standing villain Mordok, who's the mental organism designed only for killing. Trump appears as a huge head with tiny limbs in Spider-Gwen Annual 1, not Gwenpool. Jason Leto, the writer, doesn't specifically call his villain Trump, but the likeness appears rather more than coincidental.
Has there been a more maligned potential presidential candidate?
Well, I don't think there is, but, you know, he also kind of asks for it.
Yeah,
you know,
he does.
He puts himself in a place
where... Have you seen the video, the cracked.com video?
No.
What suggests that even putting Donald Trump forward as president was just a gag, and they're waiting as long and long as they can before they admit that it was just a gag, but even though he's saying ridiculous things, you know, I mean, and the eventual gag is the American public love him.
Yeah.
And it's got a little bits cut in between where it's just got on the phone Donald Trump just crying. He says, I don't want to be president.
Can you imagine, though, if Donald Trump was brilliant. Actually just an actor? you know, like Iron Man 3. With the Mandarin, if the whole thing was just him being an actor.
He takes off the wig and he's actually like somebody who's a really well-trained thespian.
Yes.
From like Scotland.
Only reveal himself after he's won the election.
Yeah. The Scottish bit is important because of what he's done in Scotland.
Yeah. So can you imagine, that'd be hilarious if all of a sudden at the inauguration he's like, he just takes his face off like some Scooby-Doo ending.
And it's Peter Mullen. Like, what? How would you do that?
No. It'd be hilarious if it was actually Peter Dinklage in kind of a robot suit.
All right. It'd explain why they got their hands out of whack.
Yes. Couldn't quite get it right.
It's one bit they couldn't do. I mean, I can't draw hands, so maybe making robot hands is just as hard.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Anyway, we're going to take a very quick break there, and we'll be back, and we've got plenty of poetry and stuff and all sorts coming up.
Hey, so, films. Those are certainly things, right? And if you want to listen to much better film analysis than that, listen to Cinema Eclectica, also on the Geek Show Podcast Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back. And now we're going to be talking about some books, some definite books. They are definite books. They've got pages and everything. And leading us on that charge is Rob, who's been gigging a lot.
Not in years, but... Yeah, and they got all pretentious. It's not a book. It's not even got a story. Yes, it is. It is Gig Posters Volume 2. It is a book, even though Andy rebelled against that very idea. But
I like books with pictures.
It's just books with specific pictures. I mean, Gig Posters is a website ran by Claire Hayes since 2001, which is like a platform for people to put gig posters in, download, buy, all sorts. It's a great, great platform. But this is the second volume of their book. And it's got a series of artists who it's chose to present in this book. And it has like two pages of their work. It'll go through who they are, why they get into gig posts, influencers, remarks. And the interesting part about it is it has such a variety of art styles. I mean, when you think about like music events or whatever, in the mainstream, it's just like a poster of the people in the band sort of posing.
Yeah.
And have the days. And it's very much of a muchness. It's not particularly interesting as a visual thing. But in the more outsider aspects of music, you get into rock, you get into hip-hop, you get into stuff like that, metal, whatnot, you get more of an artistry to it. You get like influences from all spheres and distinctions and classes of music and art story. But yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, it has like the pop-out bits so you can pull out the full-page posters and put them on your wall, which is a really nice aspect because a lot of the posters are very, very striking. But I just want to run through some of the artists who piqued my interest. And the first one is an artist called Anvil from Houston, Texas, whose art style, you know the old pulp magazines and old pulp book covers from the 1950s? He has a lot of that. I mean, one of his posters for a band called Social Studies, who we can't say I've heard of, he has like the old sort of medicine cabinet stuff from the Western Age, you know, the old oil snake salesman, so that style of their thing.
Yeah.
And just going through, I just want to highlight it because the massive variety of stuff which you can find. But another one is called Blackheart Studios, which has done all sorts of stuff. Modest Mouse, Jucifer, Built to Spill. I mean, his style's much more comic book inflected. I mean, he's one for Modest Mouse. It looks like sort of a nightmarish fuel version of Popeye with a seal playing a horn.
I've seen actual artwork like that on some of the, you know, the underground comics, some of the ones that I've encountered.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very fantastical and interesting. And
slightly anarchic as well.
Yeah. The Bubble Process is another one from Cleveland, Ohio, the other Cleveland.
Oh, that's
Brooklyn.
That's gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, it's a severe, they're all heavily lined and it's really interesting. I mean, I know I'm describing art and there's only so much you can say about art, but another one is Eric Montez, who has there's a thing online who do like movie posters for exploitation movies called Mondo Movie.
Yeah.
The old Mondo posters. And he brings that sort of influence into things. I mean, with Bon Iver and other sort of artists. Another one is Graham Pilling, who has a much more expressionistic approach to music. He uses monsters, he uses wildlife and sort of contorted shapes. I'll just do a few of his, but there's Ivan Minslov, who has an absolutely stunning...
That one is beautiful.
And you will know us by the Trail of Dead, who are a very, very popular indie outfit. And it's just a skeleton hunched over backwards with a blue flame gushing from his chest.
Yes. And just red. It's just red all over.
Kill Hatsumoto Prince, another one who picked up my interest.
Did you just pick out all of them?
No, no. Mark with a Q, Sputzer, who has a very, very interesting sort of comic book. What's the name of the noir comic book author? Brubaker? Ed Brubaker?
Okay, which... Well, it depends. There's several. Are you on about the one who did 100 Bullets? Or?
No, no. No, this is a guy who's been going at it for decades upon decades. Nat Dam has in particular interesting style. There's one called Punch Gut, who has a very, very comic book style in their work. Just a few more, and then I promise you, I'm done. Two Rabbit Studios, who have an absolutely outstanding art style. I mean, one poster who they've done for the very, 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 very well-known Flight of the Conchords. It looks like an offshoot from the very, very popular comic book series Saga, in which a part of that mythology has the robot species, which have TVs for heads. It's very, very interesting. And, but basically it has, one page has, all the details of who they are and their style. And the other side has, a cut out of the sort of, that sample poster. But I'll just run through the list so you have, an idea. If you like this sort of music, this book is basically for you. But there's a fair few, but I'll just run through them. Asimov's Temple, and You and Those by the Trail of Dead, Arcade Fire, Avett Brothers, Bon Iver, Bonnie Prince Billy, Broken Social, Saying Cake, Coheed and Cambria, Death Cab for Cutie, and just to jump into the last column, Pavement, Fish, and I think that's how it's... I've never heard of the band, but P-H-I-S-H. I say that because there's a band called Fish. Spelt the original way, so that's a bit confusing. Queens of the Stone Age, Rage Against the Machine, Shonen Knife, Slayer, Sonic Youth, Spoon, Yola Tengo, Ween, Widespread Panic, and Worldcore. So if you like rock music, indie music, that sort of thing, this book is the definitive, just a weird music hipster like I am. This book is a great tabletop book, and this is going to go missing because you two are going to look the other way and I'm just going to vanish into the night. But yeah, that's Gig Posters Volume 2. Excellent, excellent stuff. Some beautiful art in it.
I like the sound of that. Right, so how do I follow a bunch of gig posters that are really artistic and really interesting and really creative? Well, by taking a journey back to the greatest female protagonist in modern fantasy. Yes, that's right. We're off on another journey with Isabella Lady Trent in The Tropic of Serpents by Marie Brennan, which is a memoir of Lady Trent.
Big fan of this, aren't you?
I absolutely adore Lady Trent. I wish she was real so I could sit there and have tea and cake and listen to her stories. And Andrew is exactly the same. He's read A Natural History of Dragons now. We both wish that she was real so we can sit there and have tea and cake and listen to her stories.
I expect she'd be very posh.
She would be, but also very, very down to earth and very, very... She's the kind of...
I suspect she'd be like Ranulph Fiennes.
Yes.
Like a female Ranulph Fiennes.
Oh.
With a lot of History of Dragons in her.
Well, yeah, but also with a lot less politically correct than Ranulph Fiennes as well.
Okay.
She's more direct. And the thing about these memoirs, they're written in a style where they're not apologetic at all. They just kind of, yeah, okay, I caused a scandal. So what? I'm too old to deal with that stuff now.
Okay.
So anyway, at the end of A Natural History of Dragons, she was the Knave of Skirland. She was causing all sorts of controversy because she didn't want to do what they wanted her to do. She wanted to make a place for herself rather than have them... I mean, it's an actual line from the book, right? I set to work making a place for myself in society, even if it was not the place society intended for me. That's the mentality that she has all the way throughout all the four books that have been released so far. Anyway, Tropic of Serpents is very much another adventurous tale of Isabella Trent when she was younger and still called Camhurst. And the interesting thing about this book is that, like A Natural History of Dragons, it's set at a time when academia was more for men. It was kind of taboo to have women as academics, right? Because the woman's place is in the home and everything like that. And she is basically, she combines all the best bits about, say, Charles Darwin and Indiana Jones.
That's an odd cross-section of the person.
Do you see what I mean?
Charles Darwin and Indiana Jones.
Yeah.
I like it.
No. She wants to pursue her dream of studying dragons and basically being an academic. She deals with the criticism from all corners of society about what she's doing. She also has to go through a lot of guilt because she puts her research and her job ahead of her family. She ends up with a son called James. And a lot of this book is kind of taking what happened in Natural History of Dragons and putting it into context, so to speak. The story starts off when Isabella is about to start on her next adventure. She has to go to Eriga, where she's going to be studying swamp worms, and swamp worms amongst other species. She's going to be studying the wildlife, the fauna and flora of Eriga. It's a difficult journey, and there's going to be all sorts of things that they have to maneuver. Right when she gets there, she gets mired in politics and given a mission that she really doesn't want to do. And there's also all sorts of outdated restrictions placed on women in specific, and she has to go against those as well. And Eriga itself has loads of dangerous animals and loads of dangerous creatures and insects and stuff like that. So she's already up against it in terms of being a researcher. On top of that, she is still in the bad books of her homeland of Skirland, where all sorts of people are gossiping about her and basically backbiting her and being snide and everything like that. Most of the gossip involves what she did in Natural History of Dragons. She's classed as a young runaway heiress who is a bit mad and doesn't mind causing a scandal. A lot of this book, though, like I said, is about putting what happened in Natural History of Dragons in context. Isabella finds herself in a position where she can't do the things that she wants to do for various reasons. She has to begin facing up to the guilt of getting married, having a kid, but not spending time with that, of being, as she calls it, the worst mother in Skirland, and as other people put it as well. And she has to start coming to terms with the fact that she never really understood the implications of becoming a wife and a mother. She never really understood any of that because she was so focused on what she wanted to do. And that degree of selfishness from her has come home to roost a little bit. So she's having to face up to the realization that she has obligations outside of her research. She has the other responsibilities that she needs to take just as seriously as her research as well. Not only that, the fact that she is effectively one of the leading women of the age, that puts a different type of responsibility on her. And as much as she doesn't want it, she also has to face up to that as well. And that, as the story progresses, begins to affect her more and more. You know, not just the story in this, but the story in the future books as well, until it all comes to a head. But anyway, the language in this continues to be wonderful. Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Just to give you an example from the very first page, the preface, because this is a memoir. This is written first person, right? Public opinion is a fickle thing. Nowadays, I am hailed from one end of Skirland to the other as a testament to the intelligence and derring do of our race. Indeed, if I am not the most famous Skirling woman in the world, I dare say I give Her Majesty the Queen a good fight. I would not go so far as to presume I am universally loved, but if any news sheet sees fit to mention me, as they do not so often anymore, on account of my signal failure to make any new shattering discoveries in the last decade, nor to nearly get myself killed in suitably gruesome fashion, chances are good that mention will be favourable in tone. It was not always so, though few are old enough to remember it, and even fewer rude enough to bring the topic up. I was once reviled in the scandal sheets, but I have no compunctions about washing my dirty linen in public, not when the linen in question is so very old and wrinkled. Some of the errors I was accused of were entirely baseless, others, I confess, were entirely fair, at least insofar as my own opinion may be trusted. See what I mean about the language?
Very comedic.
Well, no, very, very Victorian, very formal, but also very funny.
Quite acerbic as well.
Yeah, because when she's writing this, she's supposed to be more like the matriarch character. She doesn't give two hoots who you are. She's been around the world. She's seen things that you could only dream of. She's done things that most people could only dream of. when she's much older, much wiser, she's going to sit there and look at you and go, well, what have you done today? And that's the angle that's coming from. And that's one of the writing is very, very honest. It's very forthright. It doesn't really apologize for anything. The character doesn't apologize for anything that happened. Not in the broadest sense, I should say. When it comes to things of family and stuff like that, you see the guilt. You see some of the stuff that she had to learn because nobody had ever taught her. You know? And she was so focused on what she wanted to do. She ignored any of the warning signs as well. So there is that, you know, you see the regret in some of the, but she doesn't try to hide it. And Marie Brennan has done an amazing job actually writing from the perspective of this character. It is absolutely amazing. I mean, okay, there are some characters who aren't as fleshed out as maybe they could be. You know, there are some scenes that maybe aren't painted as well as they could be. But this is a memoir. And I have to keep reminding people, this is a memoir. This is told from the perspective of being an autobiography, right? Mm. And if you read an autobiography, you're going to have characters who aren't fleshed out. Because human nature is such that you go through life and you meet people, but you meet them for a period of time. You don't know anything about their history or what happened to them before. It's like if you're going through a town, right, and you pull up at a service station and you go to the shop to buy a sandwich, the guy behind there, do you need to tell his entire life story for you to say, how much is this sandwich? Do you see what I mean? And it just seems like a lot of people, when they read books like this, especially these books, a lot of people are looking at it and going, well, this character wasn't fleshed out, and this character wasn't fleshed out, and this character wasn't fleshed out. I want to know more about these characters. But that's not the point of the book. The book is telling her story, not theirs. And that's the point I just want to remind people about. It's her story, not the story of other characters. And because it's her story and it's written from her perspective, a lot of the time she's not going to know about the history or what this character had for breakfast or what this character bought when they went out shopping. She's not going to know any of that because she's not privy to it. You see what I mean? So anyway, Tropic of Serpents, really, really good addition to the series. It is, it's wonderful to read. It's wonderful to enjoy. And
just as on that point, it'd make a great audiobook, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
Because of the way it's written.
Yes. It would absolutely make a great audiobook. Not only would it make a great audiobook, I reckon that this is one of those stories that would make a great TV series. Because the dragons are very, very underplayed. See, the thing is, with the natural history of dragons and with this, one of the things that you find is that it's not the big fantasy magic dragon type thing. They're very, very natural. It's as if they're normal creatures. The world that Marie Brennan has built around this concept is a natural world. There's tribes where they worship the dragons because the dragons are massive creatures, so they're considered like gods, but they're totally natural creatures. It's just a big flying lizard, after all. Do you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So when the first book was called A Natural History of Dragons, that's literally what it meant. The dragons were just native to that world. There was nothing different. There was no magic or anything like that. And that's the great thing about this. She's done dragons, but completely ignored all of the magic, and they work so well.
That's the best. That's the best way that they do dragons, I feel.
Yeah.
And dragons are like, oh, mystic, magical gods of fire and wings and death. It's kind of overplaying the role in literature at the time, you know, when they were conceived as a thing. They were just a thing that existed in the world that they're presented.
Yeah, and that's the brilliant thing about this, is that it's returning to that. So, anyway, Marie Brennan, Tropic of Serpents, sequel to A Natural History of Dragons. It's amazing. It's wonderful. It's everything I wanted. And I'm going to be moving on to Voyage of the Basilisk now. And you can't stop me. No one can stop me. Except maybe Dave Gorman.
How do I move on from that? Well,
Dave Gorman.
This book, it's not as in-depth as book you've
what do you mean
reading.
It's not
and
as
it doesn't
in depth.
Have any pictures like the book you've been reading.
Oh yeah, I forgot, this book actually has pictures.
It has pictures?
Yes, this book actually has pictures, and some of those pictures are amazing. In fact, all of the books in the Lady Trent series have pictures, right? Look at that.
It reminds me of sort of the old Greek myths and the illustrations that they came up with in them.
Think about it like this, though. This is supposed to be... I mean, if you look, Rob, the cover is done like that, right? But the first cover for Natural History of Dragons was done as kind of a medical diagram.
It's very tasteful.
Yes, very tasteful. Anyway, moving on to Dave Gorman.
Yes. This is Dave Gorman's found poetry. As you
was
know,
the poetry
if,
lost?
If you do listen to On the Box, you'll realise I have talked about Dave Gorman quite a bit because of his unique comedy aspect. But he also has a hobby, as anybody that watches him would know. And what he does is he searches the comment section of the... Those comment sections where you just look to see the reactions of news stories and topics that you search online. And he puts them into a poem called Found Poetry. And it actually, this will be a brilliant thing to actually do. But yeah, he's released the book. It's been out, I think it's been out for a couple of years, but I picked up a copy when I went to see him at the town hall. And it actually is a really brilliant thing to read. Some of them are brand new, some of them are from the TV show and his radio show. But I'm going to read two specific, well, my favourite two out of this book. It was very hard to choose.
Okay.
First one is, Thierry Henry's handball goes unspotted by the referee, meaning France and not Ireland qualify for the World Cup.
And the top. Okay.
I demand a replay. It is a disgrace. Disgrace. There should be a video ref for goals and penalties. I demand a replay. It is a disgrace. An Irish player would have done the same. Be honest. Vive la France. What does this show to the youngsters of today? I demand a replay. It is a disgrace. Avoid the products Thierry endorses. Never shave with Gillette again. I used to like Thierry. I do not like him anymore. All good things, previous are now undone. The referee has cost the Irish economy a fortune. Will he pay us back? No. Platini, French. Blatter, Swiss. Referee, Swedish. Says it all, really. I demand a replay. It is a disgrace. He should never referee a match again. Shame on FIFA. Shame on you all. This game had two losers, Ireland and football. But the biggest losers are the French. I am French. I am ashamed and I am sorry. Cheat is the only word. Cheat and liar. Vavavoom, vavacheat. Until they stop the cheats, I will not watch football again. I will not go to France. I will not drink French wine. I will not eat French cheese. Let's see how they like it. Vavavoom, vavacheat.
Very, very good. Very good. The internet is full of idiots.
There's one more. I have to read out.
Okay.
Arnold Schwarzenegger fathers a love child with his maid.
I've read this one. This one is very, very good.
This man does not deserve to be a father. I will never watch Kindergarten Cop with the same eyes again. He's a nasty man. A nasty, 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 nasty little man. I used to be a fan, but after this I'm declaring myself to be a fan no more. I feel sorry for Arnold. It's not his fault she fell pregnant. I feel sorry for his wife. The poor woman might never trust a servant again. I feel sorry for a love child. Being a teenager is difficult enough without suddenly discovering you are Arnold Schwarzenegger's son. Why do so many people insist on calling this boy a love child? Only children born in wedlock are made with love. There was no love between this boy's parents. It was just lust. Pure, blind, dirty, lustful lust. He is a lust child. I saw Arnie once. I was watching as they filmed scenes for Twins. He started to walk over to me, but someone stopped him. Without their intervention, I too might have been groped by his grubby hands. I shudder now to think how close I came to a sex pest. You are no longer needed, Mr. Schwarzenegger. Move along, little doggy, and just disappear in the night. What you have done to your family is too much for the decent folks of America to put up with. No American would ever do such a thing. Just go back to Australia. It's where you belong. I have met him. He is not really that tall. He is only 5'10". Oh, Arnold, you are a plunker, a complete and utter plunker. Dear Arnold Schwarzenegger, you have ruined my life. How does that make you feel? It is because of you and people like you that I will never marry. Men cannot be trusted. You, Bill Clinton, Jason Orange and Mark Owen have taught me that. Absolutely brilliant. That was page 13 and 14, I think, or 14 and 15. But there must be, there's quite a lot of poems in there for the size of the book.
Yeah, it's a completely unique thing that nobody else has done. Mm. You know, I mean, poetry, I'm not a particular fan of poetry, I cannot lie. Mm. I find a lot of the people who do it are kind of pretentious about what it is. I mean, poetry is just music lyrics on either way, you know, good enough to write the music to go with it. But that sort of stuff, it's so unique, and it represents like this little corner of the internet universally, it's just outrage. He's given a voice, a ridiculous, characterized, silly, silly voice to these people who, you know, it's just outrage personified.
I mean, I heard about fountain poetry, I look through the comments and I'm thinking, this will actually make a very funny poem. But you can't.
Some of them do. Idea.
But yeah, that was £5.
Do you want to read one, Rob?
I'm tempted to. I'm having a quick look.
Yeah, I do recommend. I'm not getting paid by Dale Gorman. I recommend having a look at his stuff. He's got quite a lot of published stuff.
Hey, he's found one. Mm.
ITV's This Morning hosts Sex Week.
Go on.
The look on Andy's face. No. No. No, 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 no. This is unacceptable. I am 27. I am not a prude. I am not a fuddy-duddy. But these matters should never be discussed in public. You are a bunch of fuddy-duddy prudes. I'm a yummy mummy. It was just some yummy mummy fun. I am not a fuddy-duddy. I am not a fuddy-duddy. But what was the point of this? It doesn't matter what it looks like, because it happens in the dark. Everyone should just relax. It's natural. My 93-year-old mother saw it, and she just laughed. I am not a fuddy-duddy. I am not a fuddy-duddy. Adult relations within a loving relationship between two adults are one thing. It's when it happens just for its own sake that things go wrong. It's this liberal attitude that is turning our pretty girls into strumpets. Philip Schofield has gone down in my estimation. Holly Willoughby was never in my estimation. If it was purely educational, why did they use attractive models? They should have been ugly. That would have been better. I can't believe people have been complaining that this was on daytime TV. The show is called This Morning. When else would it be shown? I am not a fuddy-duddy. I prefer Homes Under the Hammer. I am not a fuddy-duddy. Or Cash in the Attic. I am not a fuddy-duddy, but not Bargain Hunt.
Very, very, very.
Brilliant.
I'll have a look.
After watching, not read all the poems.
We'll do one more from Rob.
We'll tag Dave Gorman in the post for this show.
Yeah.
And we'll apologise for how we're reading them.
I don't think we need to.
Found one. A Northern Irish farmer halts a Rihanna video shoot taking place on his land because he disapproves of her topless cavorting. This is not about who she is, but what the film crew have done. If the Northern Irish farmer and his entourage and film crew was to run around her property in a provocative or otherwise way without her consent, I'm sure she would have been the first to complain. This Rihanna has a good voice. It's a shame she has to prostitute it on the altar of greed-driven profit obsession. I don't use banned language, so we'll use number one instead of the letter L. Rihanna is a dirty S1UT. Dirty S1UT. She is a slag. Rihanna worships the devil. How do I know? Her biggest single is called Umbrella.
Composure.
Rihanna worships the devil. How do I know? Her biggest single is called Umbrella. It is a song about the Rain Man. Who is the Rain Man? Lucifer, the devil. That's who is the Rain Man. I applaud you, Alan Graham. It takes courage to do what you did. You stood up for what you believe is right. There is nothing wrong with that, so long as what you believe in is right, which in this case it is. It's when people stand up for what is wrong that we need to worry. Why do people always say this shouldn't happen because pop stars are role models? What do role models think models do? Models look pretty and sometimes wear not many clothes. That is what a role model is. I would have let Rihanna stay and given her permission finish filming her music video. There is nothing wrong with Rihanna filming a music video half-dressed in her bra. And she's hot, and her music videos are always raunchy, and I will definitely be watching her new music video. And this hammer had got no sense at all, and he's a spoiler sort. I suppose this is the case of her milkshake bringing all the boys to the farmyard. Milkshake was sung by Kellis. This story is about Rihanna. I know that, obviously, but it is also about a farmer, so my comment stands.
I just love the fact that you had to stop.
Yeah.
An umbrella.
Well, Lewis is a... Yeah, Rihanna's a
she's a Satan worshipper because she sang Umbrella.
Yeah, which has no means or justifications for even saying that, but that is a very good book. I hope he brings out more of them.
Yeah.
I mean, he does have the... I think it was a radio show he did them all on before the TV show.
Mm.
But, yeah,
he has, like, the string orchestra behind him doing it, so it sounds like particularly brilliant.
When I went to see him, he had the background music, the exact same.
Yeah. Very, very good. But at Dave Gorman's fan portrait.
Yes.
Where can you get that from?
Get it from his website, for Fiverr. Yeah.
Is it just davegorman.com?
I think so.
You can probably find it on Amazon and places like that as well, though. It's Penguin, isn't it? Publisher?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you'll probably be able to find it on Amazon.
Well, if you ever go and see him, you can pick there.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right, so that's us for the day. So we're going to leave you for another week. Just a quick reminder, the Geek Show Podcast Network is a volunteer organization, so please show your support, make a donation using the buttons on the website, or buy something from our shop, which is also on the website, thegeekshow.co.uk. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so using Facebook, Twitter, Google+, various other places like that, or direct using studio@thegeekshow.co.uk. or info@thegeekshow.co.uk. All of our shows are available on Mixcloud, iTunes, and various other places on the internet and YouTube as well. So do look out for them. We'll be back next week, and Andrew will be returning next week as well. So we'll be swapping Andrew for Andy once more. Maybe. We'll see. So we will see you all again next week. Until then, I have been Rob.
I've been Andy.
And I've been an umbrella.
Yes.
Oh, Rob.
Yes. See you all later.